Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Today, Neda Belurci talks about life in Iran, and Sean Guillory psychoanalyzes Russophobia. Iran is treated as a cartoon villain in mainstream discourse. What is the country really like? How is it governed? And what is the relationship of the Iranian people to their rulers? What are the effects of sanctions on the country? Here's Neda Belurci to explain. Neda Belurci is a postdoctoral assistant professor in the Middle Eastern Studies program at Rutgers. In addition to degrees in Middle Eastern studies, she also has a degree in international law. Her areas of expertise include legal practices in the Middle East, particularly Iran, political theology, nationalism, war, and minority communities. In this interview, Belurci uses the abbreviation JCPOA. That stands for the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, which is the official name for what is colloquially known as the Iran nuclear deal, signed in 2015 by Iran, the U.S., the five permanent members of the U.N. Security Council, Germany, and the EU. Under the agreement, Iran agreed to limit its nuclear program with regular inspections by the International Atomic Energy Agency. In May 2018, Trump withdrew from the deal, and a few months later, economic sanctions came back into effect. The U.S. first imposed sanctions on Iran after the seizure of the U.S. embassy in Tehran in 1979. Iranian assets were frozen, and a trade embargo was imposed. The embargo was lifted in 1981, but reimposed in 1987 and expanded in 1995. In 2006, the UN imposed sanctions on the country to get it to stop its nuclear program. The sanctions were lifted after the 2015 agreement, but reimposed 3 years later. So Iran has been under some sort of sanctions regime for almost all of the last 40 years. They have taken a severe toll on the society. Here's Neda Belurci with more. Iran is a country that's much demonized in American and other Western discourse, but it's a lot more complicated than this kind of axis of evil picture it sometimes gets painted as here. You travel there. How do Iranians, just regular Iranians, react to how they're portrayed in American discourse?
When you're on the ground in Iran and people know that you're from the U.S. or actually any foreign country, they particularly go out of their way to, I think, counter that image. Iran is known for being a particularly hospitable country. I think most famously and recently portrayed by Anthony Bourdain. But on the ground in Iran, people are very welcoming and try to be very helpful. There isn't necessarily immediately a question of why are we portrayed this way, but as you get to sit and talk with people over a couple of days or weeks or months, it definitely comes up and they want to know why that is.
What is their understanding? Of why?
Their understanding is it largely has to do with Iran and the fact that the United States hasn't gotten over the beginnings of the Iranian Revolution, most particularly the American embassy taking, 444 days of American embassy personnel being held as hostages. And then to a large extent, the fact that Iran maintains its own way, that it has in some regards tried to keep to this neither East nor West orientation. Although, obviously, in the most recent years, that has vastly changed.
How do people feel about developing a nuclear capacity?
That also has changed in the sense over the last 10 years. Initially, it was that it's definitely each sovereign country's right to develop a nuclear program. Iranians particularly understand that their program is not aimed towards weaponization. And so they also argue, particularly a number of years ago, even a civilian program would not be allowed because, again, the Iranian government wanted to maintain some control over it, right? That it doesn't want to get yellow cake from Russia, that it needs certain component parts and that it wants to develop them indigenously rather than being beholden to another country for it. More recently, some of this has softened in the sense that the economics has taken over. And so some people have started to waver about it, waver in the sort of their absoluteness on that position. But they also understand it as one person told me most recently, it wasn't enough that we had one crazy person running our lives. We now have two. And the implication the implication, that statement is the ostensible supreme leader of Iran, and of course now Donald Trump. And so this is increasingly sort of the position that's held, is we have this right, but we are also being held prisoner by these two people.
I read years ago younger Iranians actually have a fondness for America and American culture. First of all, do you think that was true then? And what's the attitude now?
There is absolutely correct that younger Iranians have a fondness for the U.S. I think that the idea of civil freedom, the idea of the ability to make money, obviously, those freedoms that are perceived as not being constrained by a religious outlook or a certain political outlook. More recently, the last couple of years have not been helpful, right? That there is still this love of American culture and the things that are quintessentially perceived as American. But again, the illegal reinsertion of the sanctions on Iran has not helped this. You very clearly have a distinction between things that are perceived as quintessentially American liberal values versus what is happening politically now, what is being espoused from the U.S. government.
Yeah, it sure seems like Pompeo and Trump would like to see Iran turn into a smoldering ruin. I mean, that seems to be their preference.
Well, even though they say the opposite, right? And that is sort of the question, exactly what is it that they want? No government, and Iranians will tell you, there's no, and because they read these things, they're very politically engaged, no government would accept the 12 sort of conditions that Pompeo put forward to the Iranian government last year. And then also that they, Iranians really perceive this as sort of, as warfare against them, right? That again, they didn't, it wasn't just that they had one sort of what they perceive as crazy leader deal holding them hostage, but now they have a second one. And they believe largely that the United States is seeking some version of regime change, whether that comes from regime collapse or a straightforward military intervention.
What about the sanctions? How much effect do they have on daily life?
Extremely. From issues of food all the way to medical necessity. Even though medicine and humanitarian aid is not covered or is exempt by the existing sanctions, the United States, more recently through Secretary Pompeo, has sort of intimated that they would be subject to sanctions, and there has not been any clear, succinct language saying, well, European nations, if you set up a mechanism, which they have been trying to do, if you set up a mechanism that would provide humanitarian aid to Iran, medical equipment, that you will not get sanctioned. And it's the lack of this clear language that is really, one, prohibiting aid going through into Iran, and two, causing the spiraling of costs from basic nutraceuticals and vitamins all the way up to dialysis.
The U.S. is doing its best to constrain sales of Iranian oil too, right?
Absolutely. So on the same time, while they're inhibiting aid, you do have what are the secondary sanctions so that there aren't waivers. So this particularly, you have huge buyers of Iranian oil traditionally being Japan and India who have said, because of pressure from the United States, that they will not buy Iranian oil. Russia and China, who are the largest buyers outside of India and Japan, have said also they won't, but we have clear indications over the last about 6 weeks or so of what some would term black market smuggling. The Iranian government is calling it the gray market. So where you do have sales via tankers, right, where they turn off their radar, so you can't really tell where they start from, where they go to, and importantly, what their stops are, right? So Singapore, I believe, recently has gotten a few carriers in Hong Kong, and of course, more going into China.
And now let's talk some about the government and the relation of the people to the government. I think there's a notion among some Americans that it's a police state. People, you know, live in fear, perhaps as bad as Saudi Arabia. That's an exaggeration, right?
To an extent, I do have to say, if you are not involved in politics, explicitly involved in politics, for the most part, you really don't have much to fear for. Human rights lawyers, obviously, they are not in a good position whatsoever. Labor leaders, also not in a good position. So these types of individuals who are fighting for and advocating for certain rights that they consider inalienable, obviously, they are under extreme pressure they're arrested. They have long prison sentences. But for the most part, outside of these specific fields of advocating for, and I also obviously have to mention minorities. So outside of these fields and those advocating for rights, then yes.
What kind of minorities are you referring to?
Largely, I focus on religious minorities, so largely Christian Armenians, but there are also Assyrian Christians, obviously Iranian Jewish minority, as well as the Zoroastrians, and then ethnic minorities. So we could be talking about Kurds or Turkmens, amongst a whole host of others. So Iran has about 14 to 16 ethno-religious minority groups.
And the system of government, people do vote. It is a democracy of some sort, although the people who are allowed to run are tightly controlled, right?
Yes. So there is generally several thousand people every 4 years who will want to run for president of Iran. And that group is called by the Guardian Council. So it gets reduced down to about 8 to 10 normally. And then slowly voting will happen for those approved men also. There is historically, a woman has never made it through the calling process.
What are the standards of judgment for approval or disapproval?
So this is where it gets very vague. There are constitutionally certain elements where anyone running has to meet those. And then within those constraints, what determines a good person or sort of an educated, knowledgeable person then gets a little vague. And of course, you cannot be a minority either, right? So you have to meet an age requirement. You have to meet a religious requirement.
And a gender requirement.
And a gender requirement. So this will automatically get rid of a large portion of the volunteered candidates.
There's a caricature in the U.S. that they're basically two political factions, you know, like these hardline, reactionary, religious, superstitious types, and liberal modernizers, maybe concentrated in north of Tehran. That's the Iranian political spectrum. What does it really look like?
Oh, it's much more complicated than that, right? So if we just take sort of the big groups of the spectrum, you will have your neoliberal reformists, your centrists, which currently are represented best by the current president of Iran, Hassan Rouhani. And then you have your, you know, a little bit right, and then you have your extreme right, who I think is best represented by sort of the cleric Yazdi, who used to help and give advice to the former president of Iran, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. So he's considered sort of extreme right in that he believes and espouses millenarian ideas. And then you have, again, someone like Rouhani, who is religious, who's clearly who approves of that, but leaves room and thinks more pragmatically about how government should run, right? It's his government who said, well, you know, there was the survey, nearly 50% of Iranians don't believe in mandatory hijab, right? And that's more about governance. What makes it easier to govern? How will people be more participate in the governance and not be against the government, really, right? And then you have somebody probably more, as he's left office, the former president of Iran, Khatami, who faced a constitutional crisis, right? How does the president of Iran be the head of government, but not the head of state? And that's clearly a crisis that exists within the constitution of Iran. And Khatami had that really face him with the riots of 1999. And then every so often throughout his tenure, and he backed away from it. More recently, he's advocated federalism. So the question is now, what does that exactly mean? And he said that while he's not allowed to speak publicly, his image is not allowed to be broadcast publicly in Iran. So he has, since facing this sort of crisis, moved increasingly, one would say, from the center to sort of middle left on these sort of social issues. I want to be generally the Iranian populace has, or the presidents and governments have moved towards a quasi-neoliberal economic policy that has not worked out, given sort of the constraints that they've been facing, as well as their own budgetary problems, particularly from the Ahmadinejad presidency.
I'm speaking with the Middle Eastern studies scholar, Neda Bulurci. What do you mean by the contradiction between being head of state versus head of government?
So the president of Iran is the elected, right? So there is a segment of the Iranian government that's elected. So your representatives in parliament, your mayors, your president, that sort of image mimics what we have in Europe and the United States. But the president of Iran is limited by the power of the supreme leader. So everything that he does generally has to be approved by whoever is the supreme leader. Ali Khamenei historically was a little bit of a micromanager, and so governments have had issues with him in the past, despite some analysts saying, well, he's increasingly using his power. I think that in the last couple of years, you've seen where he has actually gone with and approved of what the Rouhani government is doing. So there isn't per se that crisis in that the president wants to do something but is constrained by the supreme leader. This is the crisis where you have an elected official who is hamstrung by somebody who technically, functionally sits on top of him in the power hierarchy. And as a result of that, whoever is within the president's cabinet also has to face constraints by the Iranian military and intelligence services. So you basically have two arms of a government that kind of come against each other in terms of ideas and function of government. And so this is sort of the crisis and the daily issues that the Iranian government faces is they're always against one another. But sometimes, as in now, there are outside sort of factors that bring them together.
And it's not clear what Trump and Pompeo and Bolton think that all this pressure is going to do. But I guess part of what they're thinking is that they want to turn the people against their government. How likely is that? What is the attitude towards the government? And what will the influence of this kind of U.S. pressure be on that attitude?
Right. So there are two sort of purposes that have been deemed out. One is that the Iranians, because of this pressure, will come back to the negotiating table, and additional provisions or sort of limitations will be placed on whatever becomes the new JCPOA. I don't foresee that happening in the near-term future. I think the Iranian government, as the Supreme Leader has said, sort of imagined that this would happen. So one, you have to understand that there might be already some mechanisms to deal with this. And two, Iran has, even though sanctions are what brought Iran to the negotiating table before, this is particularly onus to the Iranian government, and you have that President Rouhani himself sort of said that. Everyone has talked about the need for respect, so I think in the short term we're going to see this is going to drag out. The secondary goal of the Trump administration has been to reduce Iranian funding to proxy groups, and so there also seems in this sense, I think you have sort of seen Hezbollah came out and said, you know, we have to reduce our spending. But I think there's a mistaken notion that however much there is a decrease in Iranian GDP or its budgetary allocations, there will be a similar decrease in spending, i.e. if Iran loses 20-30% of its expendable funds via these new sanctions, then there will be a 20-30% decrease in funding for groups. This is kind of a little questionable in the sense that Iran perceives these proxy groups to be strategic assets. And so you can't automatically assume that there will be a direct correlation in reduced funding. Nevertheless, will you see, I think, some reduced funding? Absolutely. Does this affect, so do these goals and what the United States, back to your direct question, affect how the Iranian people view their government? I think in the sense that, as you said, that they were originally, some of them felt held hostage by their government, the supreme leader. But you also have a large slew of the public who, one, either benefits or, two, believes in it, right? So you do have disaffected parties. You have student activists, you have human rights lawyers, you have the labor leaders, you have disagreements within the Iranian government itself. And clearly, from the demonstrations that have been going on for over a year and a half now, they have clearly said, particularly labor activists, that just because they want to be paid on time or paid in general doesn't make them treasonous. And so there has to be also an understanding that there is this separation, right, between groups who may want a different form of government versus those who are just participating in these riots and rebellions because they haven't been paid or they have poor working conditions or there are violations of human rights. That doesn't mean just because they are protesting for them that they necessarily support what the United States is doing. And they clearly have said that they don't necessarily seek the governmental change. Do you have some who do? Absolutely. But then the issue becomes, are you right? What the United States and sort of in this policy hasn't sort of ascertained is the political violence of the state, right? So how many people are willingly going to go out into the streets to demonstrate if they believe in regime change when you're dealing with a government who very harshly deals with those kind of activists, right? How many people are willing to go out and make those sort of take those chances when the United States historically, dating back to 1991, 1992, has not supported its allies or those, you know, and I'm speaking of Iraq and the Kurds, has not supported and has not stood behind groups that sought such governmental change. So there's a difference between people saying, yeah, our government is horrible, versus actively participating in its overthrow. And that largely has to deal with political violence of the state and the fact that this is a government also that doesn't just incur its wrath on you as an individual, it also takes into play your family. So I think you are not going to see large swings in public sentiment from Iranians.
Now, if the United States were insane enough to launch a war against Iran, what do you think the reaction of the Iranian public would be?
Generally, Iran is very a nationalist society, and you would have, I don't think that you would have the similar reaction as you had when Saddam invaded Iraq, I will say that. I also don't think you're going to have the same outpouring that you had in 2003, 2004, all the way through 2006 when the W. Bush administration contemplated it publicly. But you will have a significant outpouring of volunteers, but it will be more split than it was before. Let's put it that way. The Iranian public is really in this hard place of you look around outside of Iran and you see that everywhere else that the United States has been is in shambles, right? And so not only do you have to weigh the political violence of the state against you and your family vis-a-vis what the United States is telling you through various channels, but then you also have to look at the probability of success. Like if this is a business model, how successful has the United States been historically or even in the last 15 years in terms of government change, right? Look, you look at Libya, you look at Syria, you look at Afghanistan, you look all over the Middle East and wherever the United States has been significantly involved, it has not been successful. In fact, the semblance of security and stability that you had, even though it may not have been a good life, is worse. And Iranians have, again, like I said, not only have had the threat of war, but they have also had their internal large protests, right? Even if we go back to 2009 for the Green Revolution in that contested election, many under 35 who thought, well, yes, we're going to engage and we're going to try and change the government for better, they learned a very painful lesson from that. And their parents said, see, we told you. And so you now have two generations that are very conservative when it comes to these kind of politics. And I don't mean in the sense of American conservatism. They just are very careful about the actions that they take, particularly publicly. And so you will have lots of Iranians who speak about how they feel about the government versus the state versus external pressures, but it's going to be a significant, it's going to take an enormous impetus to get them to move from talking about certain things to action. And in this sense, they are really sort of caught in this trap between the government and what they may want versus external pressures.
That was Neda Bulurci, a postdoctoral assistant professor in the Middle Eastern Studies program at Rutgers. You're listening to KPFA and KPFP in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. Kids just wanna dance. Kids on the East Coast, kids in LA, hey! Kids wanna dance to the hit parade. That was some of Kids Just Want to Dance by The Fast from the days when Max's Kansas City ruled a portion of the world. Next, Russophobia. Sean Guillory is host of the Sean's Russia blog podcast, which comes out of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian, East European, and Eurasian Studies. Sean was on the show a bit over a year ago to discuss Russophobia, and there's been no remission of the disease in the 15 months since. He posted a series of tweets the other week. I'm a little embarrassed to admit to taking programming cues from Twitter, but these were really good, I assure you. About Russophobia, that made me think it was time for a return engagement. Things have gotten so bad among liberal pundits that Amanda Marcotte, who writes for Salon, was arguing the other day that a Bernie Sanders campaign flyer was produced by Russian intelligence, when it was actually produced by an activist in California who was quite distressed to be confused with an agent for Vladimir Putin. Here's Sean Guillory. Russophobia. We had you here well over a year ago to talk about it, and it just won't go away. It keeps coming back. So let's analyze this beast. You had that great quote you found from a British diplomat about how it keeps the emotional and unintelligent in line.
Yes.
That was what to sell the Marshall Plan just after World War II. So this seems to be a longstanding strategy of keeping the emotional and unintelligent in line.
I thought a lot about Russophobia over the last couple of years and really trying to take it seriously and what it means. And I mean, one of the things it is, and you could see this when people bring up the issue of Russophobia, that it is one of these things to discipline political discourse. And that is, Russophobia doesn't exist. This is some of the responses I've seen and I've gotten. You're just, you know, helping the Kremlin in its horrible policies. You're giving the Russian narrative, et cetera, et cetera. And charges of being a useful idiot, all of this, you know, kind of standard, rather banal stuff. But nonetheless, it does have an effect to kind of police the margins of acceptable discourse around Russia. And this quote that I found, and I just, you know, I'll read it again, that it's from Sir John Balfour in 1947, talking about the efforts to get U.S. congressional approval for the Marshall Plan. And he says that the high pitch of Russophobia should go a long way towards keeping the unintelligent and emotional in line. And really, this is a really revealing quote, I thought, because it really points to this disciplinary aspect of the function of Russophobia in politics.
Well, in that case, it was to sell the Marshall Plan to a Congress that was kind of isolationist and cheap, right? And use Russia to scare the hell out of them.
Exactly. And that, I think you also see that today in the United States, and particularly in a lot of the discourse coming out of NATO, is it's really given a new boost to the need to, you know, increase military budgets. The new fad now is to pour a bunch of money into monitoring Russian propaganda. It's used to boost up justification for increasing all of these budgets, both military and also, you know, which I think is a big waste of money. And that is this over obsession with Russian propaganda and social media activity.
And I feel almost guilty about doing this, but by saying these things, we're not saying that Vladimir Putin's a nice guy or that Russia is an admirable country in a lot of ways. Putin's something of an autocrat. Russia is a bit of a mess. So we're not endorsing this as the heaven on earth.
No, absolutely not. I mean, and this is one of the things, like in my kind of thinking about this, and, you know, I've been critical of the Putin government for years. And the thing is like, look, going into this hysterical portrayal of Russia is over-inflating the amount of influence and power it has in the world. It is an important country, for sure. It has nuclear weapons. It certainly is a concern, if not a threat, to its neighboring states. But, you know, we have to treat these issues in some sort of proportion so we don't go down the spiral to, you know, what a lot of people are putting forward is, you know, the idea of a new Cold War. The other thing about this, and this is something people have, you know, like Tony Wood has pointed this out and other people have pointed, Keith Gessen has pointed this out, and that is by inflating Russia as this big, bad, powerful threat, you're really feeding into the Putin cult itself. And that really helps the legitimacy of the Putin government, especially when it could point to its population to say, look, see how they're talking about us, see how they think of us. And one of the things that I've been surprised by over the last couple of years, and I think it's really concerning, is that liberal-minded Russians, Russians who I know who are critical of their government, are absolutely shocked by some of the rhetoric that they see coming out of American, mostly American liberals, and of course the American media.
Now, this made sense to some degree when it was the Soviet Union and there was a battle over communism. There was something going on that was real. A lot of the emotional energy and even some of the tropes have survived that period without communism. How do you explain this Sovietism without the Soviet Union?
Well, it comes from, I think, a long history of how the West, and here I'm using quotes, imagines the East and imagines Eastern Europe and imagines Russia. And historians have looked at this. And a lot of the tropes that really developed, you could even point to this, the 17th century, of Russia as barbaric, as Slavic people as barbaric, as despotic, as backward. You can point to the language about Slavic immigrants in the United States in the latter part of the 19th century and the early 20th century as they're kind of a stain on whiteness and the whole challenge of incorporating them into a white race in the United States. A lot of this rhetoric has persisted for a very, very long time. It's also persisted in a lot of academic and expert discourse. I don't think that these things are easily pulled back into the present, whether it and it has nothing to do really with Russia's political system.
There's something uncanny about Russia, which you touched on there. It's like it's European, but not entirely. It's a bit Asian. There's some way that Russians represent the boundary of a certain concept of Europeanness or whiteness.
Right. And I think this is also the problem, too, is, it, you know, Russians' own identity as an ethnicity in Russia, but also as a state and as a nation is very complicated. And they too are torn between, are we European? Are we Asian? Are we some sort of something else? Are we unique? I mean, they have a sense of exceptionalism, somewhat similar to the United States. So it's been a longstanding debate there as well. But I also, you know, in Europe and in North America, they're also part of that debate. And I think a lot of it is, the way I see it, is that putting Russia as other is a way to draw those civilizational borders within Europe. And we can, one of the most revealing things of this is how the border of Europe and how it's imagined has changed over the last century. In the 17th and 18th centuries, or into the 19th centuries, nobody would consider, say, Czechoslovakia or Poland or Bulgaria or Romania as part of Europe. They were part of that barbarous land. But as NATO has expanded, has the EU expanded in the 1990s, now they are part of Europe. And then those nations that are, you know, post-Soviet nations like, say, Georgia and Ukraine, who aspire to be in NATO and be in the EU, they too draw that civilizational border around themselves to say that we're part of Europe. We're not part of that backward neighbor to our east.
Curiously, Russia is an important model, aspiration for the alt-right in the U.S. and also in Europe. What is the appeal of Russia to that kind of right-wing formation?
That also goes to the middle of the 19th century, particularly with Russia's various wars against the Ottoman Empire, as Russia as the Eastern protector of white Christianity, right? Because you can say, whether they are or not, that the Russians look like us white people, right? They are battling the Muslim threat against the Ottoman Empire. Therefore, I think there's a tendency in the United States to imagine Russia also as this Eastern frontier between Christianity and Islam, even though their Christianity isn't like Catholicism or Western Protestantism. It's something weird, something else. But nonetheless, you have this. And one of the most striking things I found was a drawing, a cartoon of Alexander II from Harper's Magazine in the 1860s, 1850s and 1860s, of him dressed as a crusader against the Turks. So I think that this is another discourse that's kind of rooted, though on the margins, that has come up now more forcefully amongst American conservatives. Again, it more speaks to their own anxieties, right, that what was once the pure white Western civilization of Europe has collapsed or in crisis. Therefore, they're kind of grasping for another one. And Putin's government, with all its conservatism, it certainly plays a good place to imagine that.
You had a series of tweets the other day, which made many excellent points. One of them, though, you're saying that the history of Russophobia emerged in France under Napoleon and the fraudulent testament of Peter the Great. What's the story of that?
This is really interesting. I should make a caveat here that I don't know if France is the absolute origin, because Russophobia has many different manifestations based on the particular histories of countries in the region. But one of the early, at least historians have identified, is during the Napoleonic War, there was a book published that had this false will of Peter the Great, which basically laid out the idea that Russia wants to dominate the world, more or less. And Napoleon actually commissioned his followers to make this thing in the French media, in the French press, to propagate the idea that Russia doesn't just pose a threat to, you know, its neighboring states or France in particular, but all of Western or European civilization as such. And out of this, the testament continued to have a life in Europe. It was referred to repeatedly, and I even found it referred to by Harry Truman in 1948, who referenced it to explain Soviet foreign policy. And that, again, is this idea that the Soviet Union slash Russia is this inherently expanding empire that tries to dominate the continent, Eurasian continent, or the globe as such. So that idea originates out of this falsified document.
Well, it's like the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, that it's a forgery, but that captures a certain psychological pattern and then only stimulates it as it's propagated.
Yeah. And you know, thankfully, it seems that the testament of Peter the Great has been forgotten. But some of the issues, unfortunately, that it put forward continues with us today. I mean, you could look at, say, again, going to the academic realm, the idea of George Kennan's containment policy, or the ideas of Richard Pipes, both of which were influential in shaping Cold War attitudes toward the Soviet Union and Russia more generally. They both speak not to a particular Soviet desire for expansionism, but a Russian desire for expansionism and to dominate eventually Europe and civilization as such. And I think you see this rhetoric here again, where you see these articles, these anxious writings about Russia bringing their corruption to the American political system, infiltrating and undermining democracy in various Western European and, of course, the United States. You get this idea of, I've even seen Russia as part of a new axis of nations that include Venezuela and Iran. And so it really, these attitudes continue to flourish in a variety of different forms.
I'm speaking with the Russia expert, Sean Guillory. The idea of Russia bringing political corruption to the U.S. is a real Coles to Newcastle moment there.
Completely. And this is not to say that Russia doesn't have corruption. It absolutely does. But Russia's, and I think this is the larger point I like to make when we're dealing with a country like Russia, is that a lot of the things that it does are part of a global system that is interconnected. And the policies that it undergoes, like just take their social media stuff to throw a bunch of junk into the political discourse. I mean, this is a standard practice of large states, of global powers. So they're competing within a larger context. And that's that larger context that I think those of us who are critical of it have to deal with if we ever want to, you know, make some inroads against it, than saying, well, this is the particular origin of this state, of this political system.
And then the question of scale and proportion. The Russians spent, what, $100,000 on Facebook ads,
right,
produced the Bernie Sanders coloring book, and then compare that to what the United States did, you know, 20 years earlier in the Russian election of, what, 96?
Yeah. They can't. You just can't compare.
You just remind us precisely what the U.S. did in 96.
Well, one of the things the United States did is that they made sure that, you know, the nightmare was in the Clinton administration was for the communists to win the presidency in 1996. Boris Yeltsin had single digit popularity numbers. So the stoking of the fear of communist return really alarmed not just the United States, but the Europeans as well. And the things that the United States did in conjunction with their Russian allies in Russia was to, for example, ensure timely IMF loans, to provide moral and political support for Boris Yeltsin's policies, including not just privatization, but the war in Chechnya. At one kind of laughable point that even Clinton recognized after he said it, he compared Boris Yeltsin to Abraham Lincoln and his attempts to keep Chechnya within the Russian Federation. So, and after that, he even said that, you know, I just really screwed that one up. But that support, both the IMF principally, but the political and moral support. And then you have also, which I don't actually make much of, but you have American campaign advisors, which honestly is the norm now and was a flourishing business in the 1990s. But there is, according to Dick Morris's memoir, he talks about how these American campaign advisors would pass him poll numbers for Yeltsin, and then Morris would communicate these to Clinton, and then sometimes Clinton would give campaign advice. So I always found this as a kind of funny anecdote in relation to this obsession with passing poll numbers to the Russians or through the Ukrainians or whatever the story is for Russiagate.
Of course, this is standard practice. American campaign consultants are deployed around the world, but could we imagine what things would be like if the situation were reversed and Russian campaign consultants were working on a U.S. presidential campaign? People would just, like, their heads would be exploding.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the strange thing about it is that this tendency of, and this goes along with another tenet of Russophobia, but of course not only, is that the United States is unique and also inevitably good and progressive in its foreign actions. And even though a lot of this, you know, Russia and other states employ a lot of the same methods, though for different ends and different reasons, to imagine what it would be like to have hostile military bases are in Canada or in Mexico, or just look at how the United States has treated little Cuba for the last 50 years. I mean, there is something, I think, pathological in the inability of American policymakers and policy elites to really understand their own place. There's a certain fragility in American power.
Yeah, I mean, you could understand regular folks not precisely understanding what the United States has done to the rest of the world. But people, you know, positions of political power in the U.S. are certainly well aware of it. They've crafted it. So like they can't plead naivete.
Right. And that's the thing, too, with a lot of this Russophobia that's cropping up in the last couple of years in American media and amongst some American politicians is that this is not a popular thing from below. I think that most Americans don't give or care about Russia in any substantive way. Yeah, they may have concerns of what they're hearing, but I don't think they're on board or completely infatuated with this. Though I have to say, I've come across some American liberal friends that are convinced of a lot of the...
Yeah. I was just going to say that American liberals now are just obsessed with Russia, and they say things which, as you point out, Russian is not a race, but there's an awful lot of racist language and constructions around Russia. And American liberals who would otherwise be appalled by that kind of frank racism are just deploying it with a casual frequency.
Yeah, I think that the truth of the matter is that American liberals, just like Americans in general, are mostly okay with xenophobia. but racism is somehow a complete slander. You can live with xenophobia, but there's no way you could live with racism. Where, you know, both of them are not too different from one another. But yeah, it's really surprising, though, this issue of Russia and racism. I mean, Yasha Levine and I have had a conversation over this issue of is Russophobia racist? My view was, and I wrote that in this tweet, that it's not racism because Russians aren't a race. And I got several comments about that. And in my discussions with Yasha and some other people, you know, over the last week, I've actually come to accept more that it is a racism, but not necessarily because it sees Russians as, you know, discriminates against Russia or has derogatory views towards Russia, but more that the rhetoric itself elevates Russians to a race. And that's really the racist moment, I think, when, you know, James Clapper says something like, it's in Russians' genes to do X, Y, and Z. It's not that Russians are a race and they don't see themselves as a race, but the rhetoric elevates themselves to a racial category. And I think that's really concerning, because the last thing we need are more races in the world.
Yes. Well, you know, if you use Barbara Fields' definition of racism and race, you know, race is produced in these acts of racism. I mean, it's
exactly,
it's actively produced. It's not some existing thing in the world, but it's invented it through tropes like this.
Yeah.
And we, you know, are watching it. Well, it's happened before, but we're watching it, you know, happen again in real time now. You also say that Russophobia is a form of psychological displacement, where Russia
right.
embodies the anxiety and fears of the subject. Could you expand on that?
Yeah, this is the idea. Like, take, for example, comments about Russia undermining our democracy or Russia elected Trump. The Trump election, it's clear, was a trauma for a lot of Americans, including me. You know, I completely admit the traumatic effect of his election. And so there is like most traumas, there's a need to somehow make sense of the world after the trauma. And one of the roles Russia plays is, so you can't, it's hard to admit, particularly after 8 years of Barack Obama, that America is regressing to the point where it elects this buffoon, right? After the intelligent Barack Obama, the progressive gay marriage, et cetera. And so with Trump, you get an America you don't recognize with Trump. And so how do you make sense of that? And one of the ways you can explain it is to say, well, he's an agent of a foreign body. He's an infection that was put forward by some enemy. And here is the displacement. So instead of contending with the realities of American politics and doing a lot of thinking about how did this man get to the presidency, you just explain it away by saying, well, the Russians put him there.
Well, there's also an aspect of Trump, though. Like, he is in very many ways deeply American. He's a huckster, anti-intellectual, con artist. The racism, the xenophobia, you know, there are deep roots to this stuff. So the idea that, you know, he's certainly a turn for the worse, but he's not unprecedented.
No, not at all. And I mean, that's the thing that I think we need to really contend with, is that, you know, he is of us in many respects. And to displace that reality onto somewhere else. And this is not to say that the Russians didn't do whatever they could do to throw whatever they could at the wall to interfere in the American election. But I mean, we have to contend with the reality that this man, for worse, was elected by American voters. And that's a pressing question as we move into next year. And if Democrats think that they're going to win on using Russia, I fear, especially since I think most regular Americans don't care. They care about things that affect their daily life, that I think it's just going to be a loss.
How do we fight this? It's got such deep roots. It's a psychological symptom, a collective psychological symptom that's not really amenable to like rational refutation. What do you do about this? I'm just appalled sometimes by the things I hear otherwise reasonable people say.
Yeah, it's a really difficult question how to combat it, because I mean we're dealing with an idea that periodically emerges and has emerged over the last couple of centuries. In Europe, in the United States, it's a relatively, you know, 100 year or so old idea. I think the first, perhaps the best way to, or at least one way to deal with it, is to actually take it seriously and not dismiss Russophobia. Don't let the Kremlin define what it is. Because then you get, you know, what you would typically find out is that any criticism of Russia's policy is just Russophobia. And that's just ridiculous. And frankly, it doesn't really, we shouldn't spend a lot of time thinking about what the Russians, how they use it. But we should think about how it really reflects issues with our own society, how we imagine our society vis-a-vis Russia, how we imagine certain political institutions and ideologies, and the role that a Russia, and it could be any other state that, you know, there are many ones one can point to with American history that forces us, I think, to think about us. Because really, Russophobia isn't about Russia. It's about our own imaginations and our own anxieties and fears that we connect to certain policies that, say, the Russian government is engaging in. and then, of course, blowing them up into kind of existential issues. So I think one way to combat it is just to take the idea and its history seriously. And that's kind of what I'm trying to do, and trying to not fall into this kind of lame debate about, you know, Russian narrative and Russian propaganda, which I think is mostly an intellectual waste of time.
It can be good for a laugh sometimes, though.
Oh, definitely. That's for sure.
All right. Thanks, Sean. That was Sean Guillory, host of the SRB podcast, named after his Russia blog. You can find it on the web at srbpodcast.org. And that's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, just like we did last time I talked with Sean Guillory about Russophobia. Some of made-for-TV's So Afraid of the Russians, a 1983 song produced by John Cale. Who knew it would still be relevant 36 years later? Till next week, bye.
I'd like to feed the children, find a cure for disease, rebuild cities, and plant a lot of trees. I'd like to help the sick, build factories, give money to students, hospitals and galleries, but I'm afraid of the Russians. I can't sleep at night. So afraid of the Russians. Afraid we've got to fight. I'd like to go to space. Clean up rivers and lakes. Put everyone to work.